In the future, everything about everyone will be public, but everything since birth is archived, indexed, and searchable. So what does that do to a society?
24/7, a wake-up call for our nonstop world.
This is the 24/7 podcast, a wake-up call for our nonstop world. I'm Sarah Cook, and I'm the curator of 24/7, an exhibition at Somerset House. Over the series, we ask you to sit back, relax, to think about the world around you, and contemplate the non-stop nature of modern life.
I miss my pre-internet phone.
Many technologies were invented to simplify our lives, free us from the repetitive and the mundane, which many have. But other technologies have allowed the rise of surveillance capitalism, with companies and even employers tracking our interactions, facial expressions, and eye movements. AI systems trained by machines may soon be making decisions that will control our experience of the world. How do our interactions with technology make us complicit in this? Devices and apps mine our activity and are designed to encourage our addiction to them. We spend so much of our time in virtual space that new behaviors of self-management have emerged. We constantly update our online profiles to tell people where we are and what we're doing, and then check back to see if anyone has liked it.
How many likes have I got? Check it again, check it again.
Philosopher Jeremy Bentham wrote about the panopticon as the idea of a space in which everyone was being watched, but they didn't know when, and they couldn't see the person watching them. And this idea of complete control and surveillance went on to inform the design of prisons and schools and other types of institutions. Bentham's work also stretched into conditioning human behaviors and understanding why humans sought out pleasure or avoided pain. And this tracking and mining of different emotional states is very much at play in the design of many of today's social media algorithms. So over the course of this podcast series, you'll be able to reflect on how 24/7 culture manifests itself in your life and through understanding the ways in which artists approach some of the challenges wrought by 24/7 culture, you might rethink your own relationship to time.
You're in a cafe or on the tube, on a bus, and everybody's on the phone, including me. My name is Matt Collishaw. I'm an artist and I work across a wide range of media. The work I'm sharing in the exhibition 24/7 is called The Machine Zone. By chance, I was reading about this behavioral psychologist, B.F. Skinner, and the experiments he did in the 1950s and 60s. His experiments, which were essentially to get birds and rats to peck at little buttons and then get a reward. If he introduced a variable reward, if the pigeon didn't know when he was going to get the reward for pecking, then it would become totally addicted to the pecking. This was quite a strange development. Skinner's little boxes in which he put his pigeons were called the operant conditioning chamber, and this is essentially like a little box that's got several buttons on it and then a little feeder mechanism so that when you press the buttons, the food can then come through and you can take the food, get the reward. This, in turn, is something that we think stimulates dopamine, and it's saying what you just did felt good, therefore you should probably do it again. There are a number of incidents where he saw like pigeons do eccentric little movements, like a little dance, and then just by chance, because the reward was randomized, they'd get some food. The pigeon would then assume that that random little dance that it had done was the thing that was the trigger for releasing the reward, so it would then repeat, which suggested that this pigeon was becoming programmed. This psychology was then utilized by the software designers for social media platforms like Facebook and Instagram. Essentially, what they're trying to do is maximize your on-screen time to capture your attention, likes and comments and shares, little rewards that keep everybody coming back. those little sweeteners that keep you locked into these digital devices and into social media. It seemed to indicate that we were very mechanistic in our behavior, our learning behavior, so therefore part of the way that we navigate the world. So it goes very deep into our primal subconscious. It seemed kind of quite chilling that these experiments that happened on birds and small mammals 50, 60 years ago were now being utilized to addict us to this media. So the installation is six animatronic pigeons inside operant conditioning chambers on little stainless steel plinths, six of them, and on the wall there are two photographs of a larger series. People can walk into the room and then walk around and look at each of the works individually. Each work has like a little sensor on it, so at certain points the birds rest. To get them moving again, you walk in front of them, trigger the sensor, and off they go again. The images that I got on the wall are based on like still life Vanitas painting from 17th and 18th century. Kind of a goose or a duck draped over a table with a few onions and some radishes. Vanitas paintings are about the transience of life and the meaningless accumulation of worldly goods. The painting The Death of Chatterton by Wallace, which is at Tate Britain. This is a painting of a young man, a writer and a poet, who had written this a kind of fake account of a monk's life. This book that was supposedly written by a monk, he was later exposed that the book was like a fraud. So this is kind of quite interesting because he was constructing this fake persona, choreographing like an image of themselves that they present to the world, and that through constructing that fake version of themselves, you're building in potential of being exposed or just the feeling that you're not actually being yourself. And there's something that's quite hollow and empty and lacking in that. And the way that that painting by Wallace is painted is that you've got the guy draped on the bed falling off the front of it a little bit with his soft light coming over him. So it's quite a beautiful scene to look at, but it's this horrific image of suicide. So I wanted to make these pictures that were kind of based on that kind of image. And the idea that social media is a lot of fun and it's great for getting people in touch and keeping relationships going, but it's only a simulation of real kind of social engagement. That sliver of a relationship that we experience online might not ultimately be satisfying. It's the global economy that's being run on people's behavior. This is what these companies have managed to tap into, and something that I think Skinner was there at the beginning of understanding.
Jonathan Crary in his book wrote, "Everyone we're told, not just the businesses and institutions, needs an online presence, needs 24/7 exposure to avoid social irrelevance or professional failure." And he goes on to say, "It is equally a shift of individual life to conditions in which privacy is impossible, in which one becomes a permanent site of data harvesting and surveillance." The words of Jonathan Crary from his book 24/7, Late Capitalism and the Ends of Sleep, published by Verso in 2013. I'm Jonathan Riecke, Director of Somerset House and co-curator of 24/7. I hope you're enjoying this podcast. Following Matt Collishaw's insight into technology and addiction in his work The Machine Zone, we now hear from artist Hassan Elahi, who explains how a false accusation led to a 15-year project sharing his personal data with the public and the FBI.
You're listening to the 24/7 podcast, a wake-up call for our nonstop world. Well, these days, if you're not on some sort of social media platform, people look at you as if you might as well be from Mars. It's like, well, what do you mean? How is it possible that you're not active on anything? I mean, how do you even have a digital life? Our phones are way, way more sophisticated at knowing our deepest, darkest secrets, and many cases sharing them with people even when we don't want them to be shared. Our phones are really, you know, they're better than any spy could ever be. I'm Hassan Elahi. I'm an artist, and I work with ideas of surveillance, security, citizenship, migration. I make work primarily with photos and videos and media, and whatever else I can get my hands on. I live just outside of Washington, D.C., where we have lots of shady three-letter organizations surrounding where I work and live. So I'm the director of the School of Art at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. Perhaps my most well-known work is a project that I started many years ago called Tracking Transients. And that started after I was erroneously reported as a terrorist. So, brown guy, Muslim, funny name. Shortly after 9/11, the authorities received a report that an Arab man was hoarding explosives. Now, never mind, there were no explosives. Never mind, I'm not even Arab. But, if you see something, say something. Even if you're only just seeing it in your head and making it up, which was really the case of this bogus tip that came in. Even though the FBI, I'm pretty sure, knew right away from the beginning that this was a bogus tip, they weren't trusted to just say, hey, this is a waste of everyone's time, leave this guy alone. But it actually had to go through an entire process. And I ended up being investigated for 6 months over this. At the end of the 6 months, it concluded with 9 consecutive polygraphs. In the end, I asked, well, can I get a letter saying I'm okay? And of course, the way our legal system works is you can't be not guilty of something you never did. So ever since then, I decided to just kind of opt in and on a preemptive action report my whereabouts to the FBI. Just making sure that I'm not raising any red flags, or I don't want to make it look like I'm doing anything shady. It's like, hey, I'm not doing anything wrong. Just here's a meal of what I'm eating right now. Here, nothing suspicious. Or here's this building that I just walked into. Again, nothing suspicious. Just want to let you know. Don't get panicky. And then, a little bit things like, this is the bed that I'm sleeping in, or this is the toilet I just used. So I decided to open up every aspect of my life to the public in this way. Seventeen years ago, people thought this was absurd. Why would you want to show every little detail of your life? Why would you want to share all these details? People would look at me weird when I'd pull out my camera when we were in the middle of lunch. These days, when I talk about this project, particularly in a lot of universities and such, students will look at me and go, I don't get it. What's the big deal? This looks like my Instagram feed. And that's exactly the moment that my work has become completely obsolete, because we no longer see it as surveillance or self-surveillance. We all do it. Hundreds of millions of us are doing it on a regular basis. Dealing with the FBI for half a year, I learned a few things about them. One is that it's a one-way street. They're in the business of gathering information. They do not provide any opinion. They do not editorialize. It's one way. That's their job. And they're very professional. They're not friendly, but they're not unfriendly. It's very much like talking to a wall. In many ways, the FBI really does live up to their reputation of being just the facts. So I decided to engage exactly that and give them just the facts, just the pieces of evidence and piles of this evidence over and over and over. Generally, when most people are accused of being a terrorist, their response isn't, how can I give you every bit of information about my life? Usually it's much more the opposite reactions. Conceptually, thinking about circumnavigation and thinking of Magellan, where you go far enough to one side, you end up in the other. In a lot of ways, I've really looked at this as defiance through compliance, that I'm so helpful that I become unhelpful. It's also borrowing the simplest principles of economics, of supply and demand. If you think about it, the FBI, or not just the FBI, but any intelligence agency, regardless of who they are, they all operate in an industry where the commodity or the currency is information. The reason their information has value is because no one else has access to it. By cutting out the middleman, and if I just give you the information that they have, therefore it devalues their currency. So if every one of us put this information out, if hundreds of millions of billions of us started putting out our own information, essentially it would collapse their currency and it would force them to restructure their entire economy in a completely different manner. So the project was very organic in the way it came about. So the very early stages, there were phone calls. The phone calls turned to emails. The emails got longer and longer. The emails got longer with photos. Then the emails got longer with photos and with websites that I would make to show specific things. And then it got to the point where I started thinking to myself, well, why is it that only the FBI gets to know this? And that's when I decided to open up every aspect of my life to the public. And that's when my location and my images and my database went public. And really, that was probably the main point when I decided to make my life an open book. This happened at a time when this was very unusual. We didn't even have a name called social media at that time. So it's interesting watching how this project has evolved over the years as our digital culture has shifted around and with it. There's a bizarre sense of safety that I have, knowing that at any given moment there might be 50,000 people looking at me. Or not necessarily at me, but at what I am seeing outward. You know, there's so many of the selfies that we take. I also like to think of the selfie as the cultural manifestation of the war on terror. This idea of, you know, where do we take our selfies mostly? Probably most of us in the bathroom, which is the hyper-personalized space. You almost never, ever, ever share that space with anyone else. It's you, the mirror, and the camera. And when you take that photo, you're logging in your exact locations. You're logging in all the metadata. You're reporting in, I'm safe. I acknowledge myself. I'm okay. And then you do this over and over and over. Or if you do a selfie with your friends outside, we'll hold the camera up and we'll hold it up at an angle. Well, first, that angle kind of makes us look a little better. But if you follow the trajectory from the eye to the camera to the wall, that is where the surveillance camera would be mounted. So this internalization of surveillance has become so normalized today. When I was going into the questioning to the FBI building back in 2002, where I would tell my friends, if you don't hear from me by tomorrow night, this is where I'm going. This is the person I met with. This is the office number. This is the receptionist. This is all these details. We're creating these alibis. We're creating these safety nets around us. So really using visibility as a safety net, as a way to empower rather than be victimized by it. In the early days of the project, this was about, well, if we flood enough information, they won't be able to keep up with the information, which works for 2001, 2002. It does not work for 2019. We've seen a real technological shift in the last couple of decades. And one of them being machine learning. And the machine becomes more proficient the more data you feed it. At this point, it's no longer a way of hiding it. Actually, you're actually perfecting the machine by giving it more data. The problem with this is if you do have tiny bits of information about you out there, that's a problem because it's a red flag. You're an outlier. There's no way to go off grid. And if you do go off grid, you've raised some red flags and warnings. I don't think this is all doom and gloom. This isn't a matter of that it's all hopeless and there's nothing that we can do. No, we actually have a lot of power and we can control this. We can opt in and preemptively change the direction of what we want to do with these devices. To think of this as a one-way street, I think, is inaccurate because we all have cameras. As a matter of fact, there are far more cameras than people at any given moment in a room because often there are two, sometimes three, sometimes four cameras per mobile device. So we generally tend to fear Big Brother as this one way, this big camera looking down at us. But there's seven little cameras, at least in this room, or if you want to look at it on a broader perspective, thousands and thousands of little brothers looking up at Big Brother. So we can use these tools and these devices to hold other systems accountable. And I think, you know, let's not forget the power that we have as individuals collectively and that multiplied with our devices and with our technology. I think we're already there in terms of 24/7 surveillance. It's only a matter of how do we deal with it. Our military and our corporations have figured this out. I think on a personal level, where do we stand? And where do we engage with this culture? I don't think this is something we're going to escape. I think there will be a different level of efficiency. There'll be different types of operations. And also, I think we're going to see huge shifts in labor. And as we see huge shifts in labor, this will change the future. And my hope is that it just makes us more human. And we really have to become much more human about this as every other aspect of our lives are being mechanized and automated.
This is the 24/7 podcast, a Somerset House production created in response to the exhibition 24/7, a wake-up call for our non-stop world. The exhibition runs at Somerset House until 23rd of February 2020.